now with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Houck.
Right. Good evening, everybody, on this fine November 6th at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and wherever you are in the world at this time, welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, helping you find your courage to reclaim that which has always been in you. In fact, finding your courage and wisdom to remove everything in your life that hinders you from discovering who you truly are as a soul. I am very pleased to be with you here tonight and every other Wednesday evening, like I said, at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. I'm Dr. James Houck, and if you would like more information about me or to leave me your comments about tonight's show, please visit the website. It's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. That all runs together right there. So www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And these broadcasts are also converted to podcast format in case you want to go back again and listen, or you can go back into the archives and listen to previous shows. And they're also now available for download on Audible and Amazon Music. And if you would like to call in and be part of tonight's show, I invite you to call that toll-free line at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And give me your insights. Give me your comments. Give me your thoughts on tonight's subject. Schools in session, learning those karmic lessons. Well, now, in my fifth year with BBS Radio, these broadcasts have always focused on the continued integration of spirituality and our mental health, all within the context of our relationships with ourselves, relationships that we have with one another, and our relationship with God or the divine. And this integration of our spirituality and our mental health is very essential because at any given moment, our minds interpret what we take in through our senses. And based on our previous experiences or education levels or our upbringing and so forth, our mind's interpretations of our experiences really fail to capture a more accurate understanding of these deeper lessons or these deeper realities and these greater truths that really point us to remember who we truly are as a soul. Now, the reason for this is that our egos, which are very self-centered and very limited, emerge in the blink of an eye. And our egos, as you and I both know, they want to take over and keep us from knowing ourselves as the vast and eternal souls that we have always been, as well as what needs to heal in the present so that we can live in a higher ascension of forgiveness and gratitude, bliss, and love. Now, admittedly, it is our egos that often lead us astray with all kinds of thoughts and self-pursuits, and really operating at a lower level consciousness, if you will, which is all bound by time and space and causation. And yet, we also need to pay attention to our egos by asking ourselves in any given situation, in any given experience, what in me has created this perception, this reaction, or distortion, so that I can better understand where my healing and transformations are still needed. And this is where paying attention to our karmic wounds or maladaptive behaviors or distorted thinking, and paying attention to these things because they do have something to teach us. If we are open and willing to transform into something better. And this is also why the integration of our spirituality and our mental health is vital for our awareness of who we are as souls. Now, here's a quick example. There's a huge difference between society's definition of love, which is conditional, and, you know, to be quite honest, it's more familiar to us. And there's a huge difference between society's definition of love and the godly or divine love. Now, according to my teacher and dear friend, he says that we often use the term, I love you, but we fail to understand that such love is conditional because it's temporary. And it changes as it goes back and forth of conflicting emotions that the mind creates, such as envy or jealousy and hatred or manipulation. You know, moreover, how many of us have ever heard the saying, well, if you truly love me, then you will do this and such. Or, if you want to be with the in crowd, then you need to buy the latest whatever. See, can't you hear the manipulation and conditions couched in that love language? See, however, godly or divine love, it's a love that's not entangled in the human emotions of the mind. It's not entangled in the ego that's based on conditions and manipulations. Divine love, instead, is eternal. It's not conditional. But it helps us purify our minds by recognizing only that which is divine in all. And quite frankly, this is what reclaiming authenticity is all about. It can be summed up in one word. Namaste. Roughly translated, because I see myself as a soul of light. This allows me to greet your lighted soul of who you are, even if you have yet to see it in yourself. Well, indeed, I mean, we're social beings who often spend our lives trying to make sense of our world by trying to find our place in this world. And as social beings, it's often within the context of relationships that we experience tremendous pain and suffering. That's true. Whether it's from overt acts of, you know, being betrayed or experiencing cruelty that somebody has inflicted against us, or vice versa, because we can be certainly guilty of doing those things to other people, to simply being in the wrong place at the wrong time. I mean, many people bear the scars of physical, psychological, emotional, and spiritual woundedness. And so the difficulty then is often finding the courage to discover the sacred, which has always been in you. In fact, this is who you truly are. You are sacred. And the sacredness often is communicated at times through our giftedness, or let's say our graces and skills, and our uniqueness that we have come into the world with. It's this hachetas, a thisness, which the Scottish Franciscan John Duns Scotus coined back in the 1300s. And we all have this hachetas, a uniqueness, this thisness, especially now that the world needs people who will begin to value and honor one another's hachetas. So again, this brings us back to paying attention to those karmic lessons in our lives. So let's begin with this question. What was your favorite subject in school? What was your favorite subject in school? Was it math? Was it English? Was it another foreign language? Was it social studies? Was it history? Was it one of your STEM courses? And part two of that question is, how would you describe your learning style? Were you a visual learner? Were you an audible learner? Or maybe you were a tactile learner. You know, put it in my hands and I can do something with it. Or maybe, perhaps you learned best through a combination of these three. Maybe you were visual and audible. Or maybe you were a visual and a tactile learner, or whatever. But we all have a learning style. Now, there is an anonymous saying out there that reads, what I hear, I forget. What I see, I remember. But what I do, I learn. You see, your learning style has more influence than what you may realize. In fact, your preferred style guides the way you learn both inside and outside the classroom. See, these learning styles also change the way we internally interpret experiences, that is, through the mind, and the way we recall information, even the words we choose to describe our experiences. Well, basically, learning is acquiring a new or modifying existing knowledge or behavior or skills or values or preferences, and may involve, let's say, synthesizing or integrating different types of information. And progress over time tends to follow specific learning curves because learning is contextual. Learning doesn't happen all at once, but it's built upon and it's shaped by what we already know. And to that end, learning may be viewed as a process rather than just a mere collection of like facts and procedures of that kind of knowledge. Well, one such person who was fascinated about learning down through history was Jean Piaget. He was a Swiss psychologist who actually died in 1980. And he was the first one who studied how children acquire knowledge. So in other words, how do children learn and how is that different than adults? And this research ultimately led him to theorize that people actively construct their knowledge by interacting with their environments. So again, he emphasized that learning also is a process. And he developed this two-stage theory for learning. I mean, we still use it today. In fact, everybody uses it. There's assimilation, and then there's accommodation. Assimilation is incorporating new knowledge into already existing cognitive schemes or the knowledge we have. So, classic example is that, let's say, a small child is exploring a magnet for the first time. They've never seen a magnet before, so they don't know what it does. You know, so what are they going to do? They're going to pop it in their mouth. They're going to taste it. They're going to hit it. They're going to throw it, like they do with their other toys, perhaps. And the child will attempt to understand the magnet by assimilating it into his or her already existing knowledge. It's like, what is this new thing? And the only way I can learn is to test it out by what I already know. However, the second part of this learning is accommodation. That is, modifying these existing schemes or, you know, these schemas, let's say, to incorporate new knowledge. So in other words, like you're making room for, you learn something and now your learning has grown. So again, let's return to this example. As a child begins to understand the unique properties of the magnet, you know, then they will adjust their existing schemes, thereby developing new ways of using the magnet. So when a child figures out what a magnet's for, you're going to have all kinds of refrigerator art next to your Welcome to Hawaii vacation magnet and the magnetic letters and numbers stuck to everything that is metal. I mean, kids just have a ball with that. But again, they've learned something new. You know, it's not, you don't put a magnet in your mouth. You attach it to metal and you hang up all kinds of artwork. So hence the term learning curve. It's basically the rate of a person's progress in gaining experience or new skills. The same learning process is at work, assimilation and accommodation. So now let's bring this idea into the realm of learning, those karmic lessons. And let's start with the question, what were the most difficult lessons you had to learn? What were the most difficult lessons you had to learn? Which lessons are you still struggling with? Which lessons seem to keep coming back around to you over and over and over again, because perhaps you've been making the same mistakes over and over and over again, and you haven't quite got the full lesson. You haven't learned that lesson, so it's going to keep coming around until we get it, until we learn. I guess there's all kinds of lessons out there for us to learn. But what about those lessons that were handed down to us that our ancestors were unable to learn for themselves. I mean, you've often heard me say in these broadcasts that everybody comes into this world with everything they need in this life, their strengths, their giftedness, their skills, their traits, their talents. That is the very best of who you are. But what if we brought with us the karmic lessons we need to learn and heal from in this life so that we can not only heal from past traumatic experiences, but also keep them from being passed on to future generations, you know, children that are yet to be born? Well, in my book, When Ancestors Weep, I talk about this principle of seven generations, which originated from the Native American Iroquois. And this principle of seven generations taught that every decision, albeit coming from an individual or society, must consider the impact up to seven generations. And here's the quote: "The thickness of your skin shall be seven spans," which is to say that you shall be proof against your anger, offensive actions, and your criticism. "Your heart shall be filled with peace and goodwill, and your mind filled with a yearning for the welfare of the people of the Confederacy. And with endless patience, you shall carry out your duty, and your firmness shall be tempered with tenderness for your people. Neither anger nor fury shall find lodgment in your mind, and all your words and all your actions shall be marked with calm deliberation. Look and listen for the welfare of the whole people, and have always have in view not only the present, but also the coming generations, even those whose faces are yet beneath the surface of the ground, the unborn future of the nation." See, although this principle of seven generations, which is, you know, just rings true over and over and over again, I mean, just imagine our thoughts, our words, and our actions seven generations from now. So let's just say that a generation is 25 to 40 years. So that would be what? Somebody quick do the math out there. Seven generations would be, four generations would be 100 years, so about 175 years or so, okay? And we're going to be long gone, but our actions will be felt by future generations who live 170 some odd years from now. The same is true with us. You know, we're dealing with the words, the thoughts, the actions of people who came before us, let's say seven generations a while back. And had they any notion that what they were doing, we would have to be dealing with today, or we might be struggling with? So again, although the principle of this seven generations emphasizes the effect that present decisions have on seven generations into the future, I believe it also provides us a social context to be able to heal seven generations before us, you know, whose decisions and karmic woundedness affect us today. Now, you might be thinking, why do I have to worry about all of this? What does it have to do with me? You know, if all of this didn't begin with me, then why do I have to deal with it? Well, wasn't it Winston Churchill who quoted George Santayana, who said, "Those that fail to learn from history are doomed to repeat it"? Another truism: those that fail to learn from history are doomed to repeat it. And still, I continue to hear from my clients that I present this to, why should I worry about all of this? What does this have to do with me? And interestingly, I also get this kind of response from the kids and teenagers I counsel. I mean, after all, they may have been told for so long that they are the problem in the family that they start to believe it. That they are considered losers, no good, and they bring shame to the family. However, I'm always quick to point out the fact that such comments come from toxic people who project their own inadequacies onto others. And two, reframe this perspective by reminding them that the reason they're sitting with me is not because they are the problem that needs to be fixed, but rather, perhaps the reason they're sitting with me is for them to realize that they are the strongest ones in the family to be able to heal such karmic woundedness in the family. And it's a beautiful thing when kids get a hold of this concept and it takes root in them. Because when this occurs, look out, they become so empowered to embrace their uniqueness, their hachayatas, and they transform toxic thoughts and words and behaviors. It's almost instantaneous because they realize they're not the problem. They're the power. You know, they're not the weakness of the family. They're the strongest ones. And they begin to claim this power, and they understand their purpose in life, and they believe in their giftedness, and they choose to withdraw from toxic relationships. And so here's the lesson for us. What if you were meant to heal and transform that karmic energy from the past, and not just kick the can down the generational road so that those who are yet to be born will be coming into this world already burdened with any mental, emotional, physical, or spiritual baggage? What would you do differently? So, what exactly is this karmic wounding, and why do we need to heal from it? Well, basically, karmic wounding may be attached to the mental, emotional, physical, and spiritual wounds we received, or that which has been handed down to us from our ancestors. And I like to think that perhaps karmic wounding is there to teach us a deeper lesson through the need to heal our bitterness, our rage, our unforgiveness, our lack of gratitude, our hate, our lust, and so forth. So here's a good example. Let's say that a person grew up being bullied throughout their life. And today, she has the opportunity to not become bitter and therefore perhaps continue a cycle of abuse and manipulation acting out of her wounds, but rather heal from her past, heal from her present abuses, withdraw from that toxic energy through the experience of forgiveness and releasing that pain, and in turn, transforming her pain into kindness, patience, and love for those who are in desperate need of that kind of healing themselves. Now, transforming the negative energy of karma in and of itself is a very good thing for us to do. In fact, as my Hindi friends tell me, karma in and of itself does not lead to salvation. However, karma is the path of change. And what healing karmic wounds do is that they clear the way for us to realize our oneness with all things, as well as ascend to those higher spiritual vibrational energies and into the fullness of who we are as souls. Let me repeat that, because that was a mouthful. Okay. Karma is the path of change. And what karmic healing wounds, or I should say, what healing karmic wounds do, is that they clear the way for us to realize our oneness with all things, as well as ascend to higher spiritual vibrational energies and into the fullness of who we are as souls. But, you know, even the Bible stresses the importance of faith and works, okay? You might be familiar with this passage in the book of James. It's in the second chapter, verses 14 through 26, but I'm not going to read the whole thing. But you'll get the point. And the author here writes, what good is it, my brothers and sisters, if someone claims to have faith, but they have no deeds? Can such faith save them? Now, suppose a brother or a sister is without clothes and daily food. And let's say one of you says to them, go in peace, keep warm, and be well fed. But you do nothing about their physical needs. What good is it? In the same way, faith by itself, if it is not accompanied by action, is dead. But someone will say, you have faith, I have deeds. Well, show me your faith without deeds, and I will show you my faith by my deeds. Yet, healing karmic wounds. Now, up to this point, karma should not be understood exclusively as bad or negative. You know, it's just not all bad, not all negative. Instead, when karma is attached to doing good things for others, then that work heals us, and it also heals others. In other words, karma will always bring us back to relationships. There it is, okay? Karma is the path. It's the path of change. So, karma does bring us back to relationships and how we treat one another. And whether or not you want to call it karma, or whether or not you want to say that what goes around comes around, or whether or not you want to say, well, you reap what you sow, what goes out from us returns to us, just like being in a cave, and we shout, we hear the echo. So think of it this way. The way people treat us through their thoughts and words and deeds, that's their karmic wounding. How we respond to that kind of treatment, well, that's on us. Or let's flip it around. You know, the way we treat others through our thoughts and words and deeds, that's our karma. That's our karmic wounding. But how others respond to that treatment is on them. And as I said before, healing karmic wounds from the past and toxic intergenerational trauma really clears the way for us to realize our oneness with all things, as well as ascend to the higher spiritual vibrational energies and into the fullness of who we are as souls. So, after the break, stick around, because I want to lead you through a way or a ceremony that I use and I have found have healed me from my karmic woundedness. So I would really like to hear your heart on this subject. So again, if you want to call in, that's fine. This number is 888-627-6008, and I will be taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I'm your host, Dr. James Houck. I'll be back with you in 1 minute. Right. Welcome back. Again, I am Dr. James Houck, and you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Well, earlier in the show, that is, before the break, I was talking about how karma should not be understood exclusively as bad or negative. Instead, when karma is attached to doing good things for others, that's the work that heals us and transforms others. In other words, karma always brings us back to being in relationship with one another, and has us really take a long, hard look at how we treat one another. And like I said, whether or not you want to call it what goes around comes around, or karma, or you reap what you sow, what goes out from us will return to us, just like being in a cave as we shout when we hear that echo. So again, think of it this way. The way people treat us with their thoughts, their words, their deeds, That's their karma. And how we respond to them and that kind of treatment, that's on us. That's ours. Or we could flip it around and put ourselves first and say the way we treat others through our thoughts, our words, and deeds, well, that's our karma. And how others respond to us or that treatment, that's theirs. So, as I said before, healing karmic wounds from the past and toxic intergenerational trauma really clears the way for us to realize that we are one with all things, as well as helps us ascend to higher spiritual vibrational energies and into the fullness of who we are as souls. Well, now I would like to lead us through a way, a ceremony, that has helped me heal from my karmic woundedness and that have been handed down to me from my ancestors. But just a little caveat, okay? Now, before beginning any kind of ancestral or karmic healing, please consider your motivation. Please. See, creating a dialogue with our ancestors, it's not a game. Nor is it to be taken lightly. However, many people find a richness that comes into their lives knowing their ancestors exist beyond the limits of time and space. Indeed, our ancestors are very much a part of our lives, whether or not we realize it. In fact, in many religious circles, there's often the belief that we are surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses, or we are surrounded by the communion of the saints. Okay. And in fact, every time we visit a loved one's gravesite or we remember them in other ways, like say a birthday or an anniversary, we are carrying on an internal dialogue with them in the conversations or experiences we have. Test me on this. This is so true, especially if we visit their gravesite. We are remembering, let's say, the last conversation we had with them, or we were remembering an experience, or we might be reminded that we never did have a chance to have that last good conversation with them, whatever it is. But we're carrying on this internal dialogue with them in, you know, the conversations, the experiences we have. So they are living witnesses, you know, and they are very much a part of our lives. And our culture here in America, in the United States, is slowly coming around to acknowledge this. You know, other cultures, they, you know, the Japanese culture with their obon ceremony in the hottest part of the summer are very much connected to their ancestors. I mean, it's just a given. And they do so on every obon festival. I mean, it's just spectacular to watch. And, you know, a lot of other, you know, Eastern, Far East, Near East cultures have this belief. African, you know, continent has various beliefs that we are connected with our ancestors. And so America is slowly catching up to this. Okay. So every anniversary, like I said, every birthday or another special occasion reminds us that our relationships continue to exist beyond the grave. And in these cases, we are reminded that some family issues have been resolved. And we have also been reminded that some family issues have not been resolved. But still, their voices of, let's say, their pain and suffering and perhaps trauma have brought us to this moment in which we are, let's say, now ready to embrace the implications of our family healing. So let's begin. Find a quiet place where you will not be disturbed. Photographs or images of ancestors are a great way to recreate, let's say, the visual cues and should be included in this healing process. Now, if this is your first time doing an ancestral healing, I would recommend that you set your intentions to work with only your grandparents, or your parents, or maybe your great-grandparents, okay? Turn off all cell phones. Make sure you're not going to be disturbed. And take time, several deep breaths, and just center your soul through a prayer or a meditation. But set your intention to consciously connect with your ancestors and offer healing for those who need to be released from being stuck in their traumatic energy. So at this point, it's also wise to include yourself, to set your intention to be released from any psychological, emotional, and/or spiritual wounds and harmful thoughts that you carry unconsciously. And be honest with yourself about any known offenses that you're not ready to forgive. Okay, we have to be honest with ourselves because nobody forgives all at once. Forgiveness is very much a process. And I deal with this with clients all the time, you know, and in fact, just today, you know, a person's like, well, I'm never going to be able to forgive her. Okay, so on a scale of 1 to 100, now give me a percentage. Where's your healing at today? And the person said 20%. I'm like, okay, fair enough. What then would need to happen in you? Or again, what would need to shift in you so that you could move to, let's say, 25% forgiveness or 30% forgiveness? And you keep working on that. So as you're moving towards 100% forgiving and releasing that person. So yes, forgiveness is very much a process because healing is very much a process. So again, be honest with yourself about any known offenses that you're just simply not ready to forgive. And at the same time, ask God for the grace needed to recognize if there are any underlying misperceptions about your ancestors or their effect on you. Okay, and so other questions that you may want to consider including would be, well, what were the lessons and rules and values that you were taught as a child? And who taught you such lessons? Which lessons do you agree with? Which lessons have you discarded? How have family secrets benefited or burdened you and your family? Which memories of your loved ones no longer serve you? Which ones still do? And what physical, emotional, psychological, and spiritual wounds do you need to forgive, to let go of, or be released from? And which of these wounds do you believe you need to hang on to, and why? And what's this internal message that these wounds say to you about you? What promises did you ever make to a loved one that you might need to be forgiven for not keeping? What have you been thankful for in your family as a whole? And how was that gratitude expressed? How is it expressed today? And when was the last time you remember your family or your ancestors told you they loved you? When was the last time you told your family or you told your ancestors you loved them? And what other family stories do you remember? And how were they told? And who was the storyteller? Well, the following is a contextual narrative that I use with my ancestors. It has brought much healing in my life, just simply coming to terms from where did I come from? What is this family that is so connected to me? And you're free to adapt the wording as it suits your situation. And when it's appropriate, be sure to include the themes of forgiveness, gratitude, and love. And some people find healing with their ancestors immediately. Others will find that their healing involves more of a process. So at any rate, you can return again and again when you feel the need to heal or be reconciled with others or express gratitude. And regardless, note how you feel before, during, and after this. journal your experiences, and above all, pay attention to your dreams. Because in the dream time, our minds are still active. We're still processing. Our brains are still processing information. So pay attention to your dreams. Write them down. Go back over them to see if there's any themes or patterns that speak to you. Now, if at any time you feel overwhelmed when you do this by any unpleasant memories, you may stop and return to this dialogue at a later time. You know, it's about healing. It's about a process. Some people also incorporate this exercise into their personal therapy for extra processing. I've had clients do that where they've done this work, and then I would meet with them, let's say, the following week, and we would process just what kind of changes that they had seen in their life and how they might be ready to go a little bit deeper. So when you are ready, close your eyes and imagine yourself in a large open area. In front of you, there are thousands of people. Some of their faces you can recognize and some you cannot. These are your ancestors, your relatives, your kin. And begin this conversation by saying, "This is your grandson or granddaughter, and I'm here to help heal our family. I've heard your cries, and I recognize your voices and the things that I have struggled and or suffered with. Your physical, psychological, emotional, and spiritual pain is my pain, and my pain is your pain. Yet, your physical, psychological, emotional, and spiritual joy is also my joy, and my joy is also your joy. Because when I have looked at my life, I have become," and here you would just need to add like a context, "I have become," the context, "at times with what I have struggled with and what has been passed down to me. I ask your forgiveness. I ask your release for not fully understanding your struggles, your pain, and your suffering. I do not want to carry this burden any longer." And at that time, ask if there's any ancestors who need to be forgiven for what they have done in their lifetime so that they can be healed and released from the trauma or the traumatic energy that has weighed them down. One or two people may step forward, or groups may come forward, depending on whether or not the forgiveness is a shared burden. And if you're centering on one or two relatives, address them by name. Look at them with compassion and realize the historical context in which they lived. You can say to them, "I forgive you for what you have done, and I no longer carry this burden. Therefore, be released from your burdens, be set free, no longer bound by your traumatic experiences, as well as any guilt and shame that has trapped you for so long. I also thank you for the blessings that you have given me and positive characteristics in my life, and name them. And I am grateful, and I thank you for your perseverance, because I am here today." And again, there also may be ancestors who come forward at that time and offer their gratitude for being forgiven and released from their trauma and burdens. And repeat this conversation as long as it's necessary. And a sense of peace may begin to fill you when you realize it's time to close. So finally say, "I love you, and I am grateful for being part of this family. Be released and go with God." Now, to close this time with your ancestors, offer a prayer. Offer a mantra or another positive meditation to reinforce the healing that has taken place. Some people I know say the Lord's Prayer or the Mula Mantra, or sing a Native American Indian ancestral song, an Irish blessing, or another favorite prayer or a hymn. And for the next few days, be particularly mindful the journal any insights, impressions, or dreams that come up in you. Don't judge them. Just look at them, write them down. And also, make any note of any changes in your perspectives regarding your present relationships. You know, how do you now view yourself and others? In what ways do you now treat yourself and others differently? And how do others appear to treat you? In what ways are you more understanding and loving and compassionate and forgiving and more patient with yourself and others? And most importantly, have you noticed now how you tell your family stories from a different, healthier perspective? See, in creating a living dialogue with one's ancestors, remember that our soul connection with them is not about placing blame or finding fault for wounds suffered from intergenerational trauma. Instead, it's this dialogue that's intended to create an ongoing opportunity for healing and reconciliation, as well as stopping the harmful psychological, emotional, and spiritual patterns from being passed on to generations that have yet to be born. See, being the transitional generation, therefore, requires us to stand in the gap, as it were, and offer release not just for ourselves, but also for all family members, regardless of whether or not they were perpetrators in their life, or maybe they were victims. And for example, I have friends who set their intention to heal intergenerational trauma from the perspective of the unborn generations. You know, much like going back 7 generations to heal the souls that are stuck in that energetic trauma, they place themselves in the role or the voice of 7 generations in the future. Fascinating when people do that. Because when we begin listening to the karmic wounds of our ancestors, becoming more aware of our soul's voice is inevitable, and vice versa. As our soul consciousness matures, we also realize that we share an eternal connectedness with all of creation that does exceed our present time and our space. And although this initial awakening is often met with excitement and joy, we're often faced with recurring questions such as, okay, now what? What's expected of me? How do I live out this awareness each day? And so forth. Indeed, these are all good questions, one which we'll spend the rest of our lives trying to answer. In fact, this continual awareness of our soul consciousness and connection enables significant emotional, psychological, and spiritual shifts in us. In fact, we no longer will be able to see things the way we used to, because our perceptions have undergone a wonderful transformation as our inner awakening challenges us to live more authentic lives. And moreover, this inner transformation compels us to not only rethink and reevaluate our former ways, but it also compels us to transcend and go beyond our perceived personal limitations and embrace our limitlessness. I'm Dr. James Hauck, and you've been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. So glad you were able to spend the full hour with me. And again, if you have any questions or concerns, or if you want any part of this show or the prayer or this ceremony that I have led you through, shoot me an email and just ask for it. Be glad to give it to you. So in the meantime, until the next Reclaiming Authenticity broadcast, everybody out there be safe. Everybody out there, behave yourselves, and above all, be well. Take care. Good night.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding around to buy a book by Dr. Hauck. It's all there. Just wander over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 p.m. Pacific, on PBS Radio TV.